And we're doing the fourth in a series today of conversations about the human sexuality document of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the document called Human Sexuality and the Christian Faith. And where we got to at the end of the day yesterday was talking about the things that constitute a healthy sexual relationship. And we had gone through many exercises and conversation with the group gathered yesterday. And we filled the board with the things that were describing a healthy sexual relationship. Let me just review those things that are echoed in part by what's included here in the document. Talking about such relationships, seeing that they are safe spaces, both physically, emotionally, and spiritually, and that this is the basic starting place. It is a place where people are safe to talk about their real feelings and fears, able to reveal who they really are, to take some risks together because of their enduring commitment together. And commitment was one of the things on the board that we went back to toward the end of the day, and that group was trying to determine whether or not there was a time frame connected with commitment. What did the word commitment mean? We talked for some while. The consensus seemed to be that there wasn't a length of time attached to that, but it has to do with people's intents in their hearts and the way that they begin and travel on a journey together. We talked about a characteristic of a healthy sexual relationship being one that is playful and a willingness to go on an adventure journey together, that's part of it. They are relationships in which emotional and physical intimacy are expressed. Partners are able to be vulnerable and to receive from and give to each other. Touching and embraces are sometimes a matter of sexual delight and at other times express closeness, protection, or acceptance. There's a continuum about touch and how touch is needed and needful in such a relationship. Trust, honesty, mutuality, equality were all words that we had generated on our list of the characteristics of this healthy sexual relationship. I had one person pose at the hearing I was at in Portland on Saturday last week before coming here, a woman pastor who was saying perhaps healthy isn't the word to be using, but in a communal Christian context, perhaps it is a continuum from what we would describe as abusive relationship to salutary relationship, sort of a reclaiming of that word from our liturgy is the kind of relationship that we're after. Respect for both body and spirit of the other, respecting the other's individual needs for time in different pursuits with friends that are separate to that individual, perhaps, than the friends that are gathered to that coupled commitment. And power in that relationship is not hierarchical or controlling. So it says fairness, reciprocity, equal sharing. Relationships are never static. They're always changing, both through brokenness and through growth, that those changes take place. And that partners are not boxed into stereotyped gender roles about what it means to be male and female, that in the growing equality of relationships, that the couple decides, whatever their gender may be, male, female, two males or two females, their own ways of dividing up the tasks that they do in their household to keep it going, and many other kinds of arenas as well. And lastly, this is describing that healthy relationships are made possible through God's grace. It is through such relationships that persons know that they are loved by God and by others. And one of the explorations for us is whether or not that sets up some hierarchy that one must be in relationship to know that you are accepted by God. And is that relationship, must that be an intimate sexual relationship? It raises the whole questions about singleness and the way we address and identify with people who are single in our churches. So the way the question was framed for us for today at the close of the session yesterday was, having listed all of those things that are the characteristics we would name about healthy relationships, someone took note that didn't say that it needed to be a particular gender of partner, as in opposite gender, that perhaps when her own family, her parents had talked with her about relationship and what they had hoped for her when she grew up, there was an impliedness along that list that was talking about having an opposite gender partner. and when she found herself as a lesbian in the midst of a relationship that met all these criteria, but happened to be with same gender partner, that upset the thing. So what we'll be talking about today is that is relationships, both relationships outside of marriage in the heterosexual context and gay and lesbian relationships, which because of our legal statutes across our country, there are no legal marriages for gay and lesbian people. And I find that is surprising to some. I, as a lesbian myself, and talking and teaching, I think when I was here last, had someone say, well, why don't you go to California and get married? Sort of like, well, California is that wild place in our country where you can sort of do all these at the edge kinds of things. And she was quite surprised to find that even in California, people of the same gender are not allowed to apply for marriage licenses.
Go to Denmark,
yes.
Yeah,
another part of that is just do some sorting out about what marriage means. And I think Denmark and some other Scandinavian countries are places where they do this. There is a legal aspect to marriage and a church or spiritual one, if you will, aspect to marriage that we have sort of collapsed together and probably have the most overlapping of church and state in our country at the time of marriage, because it is the pastor who performs that ceremony and signs the paperwork, which then goes to be filed with the county. And when you reach a time in which you might want to have a dissolution of that marriage, you have to go before a judge in the jury in that kind of legal setting, rather than back to that pastor about dissolution of marriage. So what someone was posing was that there are a couple of functions to marriage that if we separate those out might be helpful for us as we engage this conversation. And one was saying that part of it is a partnership covenant, that two people would enter into. That's one aspect of what marriage is. And the other part was a parenting covenant. And that you could enter into a partnership covenant without entering into a covenant to parent. Now, that wouldn't necessarily be part of it. And I heard testimony on Saturday last from heterosexual couples who were saying that they did not intend to have children, this particular pair who were there, and spoke of their feelings of being left out within their congregational setting because of that decision. People who questioned what that was about, and have heard from people who feel very painfully that they have been that they have not been able to conceive a child. And what does that mean? What is our church saying about technology and sexuality, about conceiving children in other ways than the sex act itself? And a parenting covenant, we were saying that it would be our hope that people would enter a partnership covenant before they entered a parenting covenant, but that might not necessarily be the ordering of it either. So she was posing that perhaps we set aside the term marriage and leave that as the legal term. And for those of us within church, as we begin addressing these relationships more broadly, we use this language, which would be encompassing of gay-lesbian relationships as well as heterosexual relationships. So let me offer that to you. What we're going to do first this morning is talk about gay and lesbian relationships in small groups. I ask you if you'll circle your chairs in groups of four or five. And several things to discuss in those groups. And I'll record these for you so you can refer back to them. First, what experiences or perspectives have most influenced how you view gay and lesbian persons? How has this been affected by your faith and your faith stances? And thirdly, the part certainly to share out with the whole group are fears or questions that you continue to have that you want to address and draw the conversation of all these minds together on. So if you'll pull your chairs in circles. One of the questions which has come up from several groups that I've sat in on here is talking about gay lesbian relationships, committed relationships, and how should the church address those relationships? And there are a number of different avenues of thought that were coming from that. But we'll cast that as the thing before us for large group discussion as we continue here. Thank you. Did you find a range of experiences as you talked in your groups, or is everyone at the same place? Oh, no, you say. Okay, say more.
Well, my own experience came first through athletics and discussions about female athletes.
Okay.
For a long time in my chosen career, which I was involved in, either with athletes or on the fringes of working with athletes for a long time. My first involvements with the issues of homosexuality, lesbianism, and so on was related to all of that. And the media, of course, has been horrible. And then for me, San Francisco, visiting my daughter and observing things and so forth.
Okay.
So those three sectors is where I've got most of my knowledge.
Yeah. Interesting starting place and different from the stories I hear from many people, because often there's a focus on male-male sexuality. And it's almost to the exclusion of, or the invisibility of, lesbian women and their relationships. So your starting place being one of that is a little different place.
Very much so.
Yeah. It was not something talked about in my own upbringing. I was sharing that there was a thing about don't wear green on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody else have that? A particular color day of the week changed depending on where you were. But you kind of got taunted as being queer if that didn't happen. You were the odd one out for the day, and you were taunted as being queer. You know,
purple was
it? Okay. Yeah. And that changed from place to place. Or the closest I got to hearing anything about the word lesbian growing up was in high school, when people would say the word thespian and really just twitter about it, because that was about as close as it came to being discussed. That was the place. What about the church's influence on your views about homosexuality?
Never mentioned very little.
Never mentioned very little?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in our group, I spoke quite a bit. To me, the church is us. I mean, you know, nobody from on high ever comes down and talks to me. I mean, I've been in almost every office in the church.
Uh-huh.
And when we have committee meetings and the conference, everything. The church is us. So, you know, the church is just not some big super being. It's our own opinions, our own feelings. I made the comment, when we have meetings, the wife in a home, the wife will set, let's say, eight places. We expect four couples to come. And she'll set out, you know, she'll make eight pieces of cake or something. We expect married couples to be in our church. So whether you're gay, whether we had a single lady in our group here, a single parent, our church is us, and we aren't relating, we aren't meeting the needs of singles, whatever the reason for them being single. It's not the church, it's us. It's our problem.
Good. All right, let's recast our question before us with that. How should we the church, address? The village has been all abuzz since I got on the boat last Saturday coming up here about a wedding. And that wedding will happen this afternoon. So far, our church has not taken any stance, or we as a group of people have not... how many people here have attended a same-sex ceremony that has been a blessing of relationship? Very few of us here have attended such, and yet... my thought about what the forum would have been on Thursday evening, and this place probably packed, if we had announced that Holden Village would be holding a same-sex wedding this Saturday afternoon, and you know, it would raise different questions for us. And some before us is, you know, what's that about, and why is that? Because when we outline the things of committed relationship, we outline the same things regardless of the gender of the two parties involved in that relationship. But it becomes another matter when we talk about some kind of, it's seen as a sanction of. Part of it depends on how we view marriage. Is there a magical thing that happens in a wedding, the one this afternoon, at which point these two people become married? Is it blessed at that point? Certainly we invoke God's blessing when we're in the midst of a marriage ceremony. The way I have heard it cast and talked about it with many people of same gender who are approaching it is to say that we feel God's blessing in our relationship. And part of our reason for wanting to hold such a a gathering of our family, community, the public around us, is to acknowledge that blessing and to acknowledge it as God's blessing, and that that is part of what that is in relationship. So Cass, some of that. You had your hand up?
I think what we as a church should address is scripture passages that we all raise questions about. And I've been fortunate to come from a congregation where the pastor would deal with that and illuminate that so that we wouldn't be condemning if we later ran into those relationships, which many of us have never experienced.
Well, there's not a proactive something that those of us who are gay or lesbian or those who are advocates otherwise can turn to in the scripture to say, yes, here's the example of that. I will take note that the scripture that talks about Ruth and Naomi and the words that they say to one another have become the common words used in nearly every heterosexual marriage ceremony that I've been to. And those are words of commitment to one another. I'll follow you where you go. Your people will be my people. Become the words of, echoed from the relationship of these two women there. Some of the particular text we spent a little bit of time talking about earlier this week, and we'll probably do more, but part of it is to understand that the orientation of homosexuality, as we understand it today, as part of our psychosocial makeup, is something that we've known about since roughly the 1860s. And the term heterosexuality as well, for that matter. It's that kind of a time frame to understand it as an orientation. So when we're reading biblical text, we need to somehow step outside of our understanding of it and know that the texts are talking about same gender sexual encounters, and many of them are talking about encounters of sexual exploitation, of power over, of gang rape. I think of the Sodom and Gomorrah story as being one of the first ones that often gets lifted up about, well, how do you erase that away? I don't know that it can be erased away. The story, as interpreted by Scripture itself later on in the words of Jesus, is that it was because of inhospitality that those cities were destroyed. And when we start talking about today issue of homosexuality and the gross inhospitality that has been the mode of the day for many churches, once they find out someone is gay or lesbian, perhaps gives a different reading of Sodom and Gomorrah text. There's a parallel story in Judges 19 in which the householder who has a male guest in the house and the men surround the house ends up sending out his concubine to them, with whom the men have their way and have sexual relations until she is dead and found dead on the doorstep. And then the story goes on that her body is divided into 12 pieces and sent out to the tribes of Israel. And somehow it is that part of violence against women somehow that we have not picked up on, or that even in the Sodom and Gomorrah story, Lot offers his virgin daughters to these men to have their way with them instead. At its best, that's a story about gang rape. It's a story of gross inhospitality, of coming to demand to have sexual favors with these guests in the village. And same-sex sexual acts, particularly male upon male, were acts of power over, sort of spoils of war. The degradation of another person became part of what that mode was about. There are just a couple places in New Testament where it talks about same-sex acts, and both of those writings are from Paul, one in Romans and another in Corinthians. I think the one in Romans 1:26-28 is the place where it talks about females with females, and the only such reference we have in the biblical material. As I address people about this, I have to ask, is it that we have set up a hierarchy of sinfulness, and sexual sins are at the top of that list, and somehow homosexuality gets really cast to the top of that? And it means that we need to rethink and retalk. What is sin, and what does sin mean? Is it a particular act? Is it something in our hearts? Is it an intent, a means towards which one would reach the end by doing anything? And all those kinds of things that need to be cast around it.
My understanding of the church in this is to love the sinner and hate the sin. And so the response, and this isn't a judgmental thing. It isn't, you know, it doesn't make any difference what your sin is.
Mm-hmm.
no matter what it may be, but the role of the church is still to love, bring back, support whatever the person.
The language of love the sinner, hate the sin, sort of casts, I think, where much of our church is today. In terms of living that out, what I find often happens is that people, there's not a way to live that out without the constant put down of that individual, of not valuing them. And part of it comes to this place of what causes homosexuality is sort of inherent in that question. And we don't have an answer, per se, as to what causes it. It seems that most of scientific literature is leaning toward, as well as psychological literature, that our sexual orientation is set for us by the time we're about 5 years old, not something that people choose. And I think that's part of the mindset of thinking that people are choosing willfully to act outside what they are. But if we understand orientation to be part of a givenness of either that heterosexual orientation or homosexual orientation being part of our givenness, why is it that it's sinful to ask people not to act on that within the context of the other kinds of things that we've established of as being appropriate for a healthy relationship?
But as you reported on the Kinsey report,
yes,
the narrow end of each spectrum of heterosexual mm-hmm. exclusiveness or gay or lesbian exclusiveness on one end is very small.
Mm-hmm.
The broad range in the middle is both. And so therefore you've got choices.
Perhaps some.
Or making choices.
You know, if we talk about how that's divided out, that if 90% of your nature, if you will, is heterosexual and 10% homosexual, then it's going to be much less difficult for you to make a decision which fits the norm of our society, which is obviously toward heterosexuality, than if you're at the other point of that, that your nature, if you will, using that parallel, is 90% homosexual and 10% heterosexual. So the Kinsey continuum gets confusing in that way, and I don't know that it is so much a choice of behavior, but think about the question, when is it that you first determined that you were heterosexual, for those of you in the room who would say that you are? How did you decide that you are? Was it
I didn't know there was any other way.
Right. And for people who are homosexual, the same thing is true for what they feel. You know, there's not any other way for me. And I think that's the part that we're missing sometimes, is the part about knowing what our feelings are. There are many people who are gay or lesbian and would say that that is their orientation, who are not involved at all in sexual relationships, have not even, are still virgin, if you will. Just as there are people who are heterosexual who know clearly what their feelings are and when their heart beats faster and who I'm excited around, and yet they know that that's who they are. So it's not just a matter of activity. Another hand up.
Well, my church background, Lutheran, we never really talked about it. But I do have a real uncomfortable feeling when I hear other Christian denominations that say homosexuals can change, and I really feel strongly that this is something a person is born with, and I'm wondering what kind of a message of acceptance and love do we want to give these people?
Mm-hmm. Another question to keep that I keep in mind when I'm reading literature of or hearing people talk of that language of change is it's never clear to me where on the Kinsey scale the individuals are that they're working with. That would be part of the question you were raising. And in some degree, it sets up for me a kind of theologically bankrupt model, which is saying, if you believe in Jesus enough, you will change. Well, I think it's presumptive of us to say what we think God's will for each one of us is, or to say that if you do this, then God will do this as the end result of that prayer, and becomes a difficult piece in that. If we believe in Tinkerbell enough and clap our hands here, will she appear, is the model that seems the parallel to that as I hear it. And that's not how I understand who God is and who Jesus is in my experience in life.
That's
yes?
One thing that's happened too, because of people trying to fit into the norm, painful relationships have come because they've, you know, maybe a homosexual has married somebody and then after years, you know, it's like, this isn't working, and so, you know, but they've needed to fit the societal norm, and so, you know, it sets two people up for mm-hmm. for a painful relationship.
Right.
And I've heard of numbers of situations where, you know, after a while they end up getting divorced and going ahead and choosing what was their original preference. But I think that's that mentality, or, you know, be trying to go through therapy thinking, yes, this is something I can change, but, but it isn't.
I think one of the struggles that we, the people in the church, and I think are, and I agree with the fellow who was talking that we are the church as we gathered here, but I also know that there is a hierarchical structure, and I don't want to sit here and deny that there is one, and that, yes, we are a part of that, but we are also, we're also somewhat removed from the powers that be. And those powers that be, I think one of the struggles is that in acknowledging, in accepting, in that indeed homosexual, lesbian, gay relationships are as right, as God-given, as heterosexual relationships, is an issue of power and control. And that to see relationships and to acknowledge and accept female-female relationships or male-male relationships, it upsets the cart. It upsets the cart of power. And the cart of power has been one of a hierarchical, male-dominated structure. And our church is a part of that. And so it's not a simple issue. It's not a simple issue of how do I feel about lesbian relationships or gay relationships or marriage, those marital relationships. With you know, how does the church respond? I think it's a frightening issue because it's a power issue, and that if as a church structure we're going to acknowledge that, then we have to re-examine everything we are and everything we believe in, starting with our creeds, with as we come to the communion table, our baptism. We have to re-examine everything. That's a lot of work.
It is a lot of work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
I agree with her about the male dominant power structure, but I also think it comes in because of interpretation. These were the people that did the interpreting of scripture and came to the conclusions. And that's hard to change. It's been there a long time.
Yeah. Historian at Yale, who is John Boswell, his book is called Christianity, Homosexuality, and Social Tolerance. And it's a wonderful historical review through the centuries about the way, even within the church, our responses to people who are same gender has changed. And I've heard a tape of his, the book is not published yet, of his locating ancient rites, which were in effect marriage rites or same gender blessing rites, that even predate heterosexual ones, you know, particular individuals of that. And there are people who are saying, absolutely, that can't be possible. But part of it is looking back from our own perspective, how do we shake ourselves free from that, but to see some other things. One real concrete example, then I'll come to you, about what you were saying that struck me as you were saying that is within my own congregation, which has been one in St. Paul. St. Paul Reformation is the name of the congregation. That has had an intentional ministry with and on behalf of gay and lesbian people for the last decade. I bet it took us 6 years before we figured out what to do about the church directory. You know, when the folks come in and set up the thing in your church basement and do pictures, they really got gorked out when there were two people of the same gender. Whose last name do you put this under? And all that kind of stuff. And it took us a while to figure out that in the listing of church directory, it would be as a heterosexual couple, perhaps with who each have kept their own last names, which is part of the patriarchal stuff that women have always taken, the male's last name, that we just needed to cross-reference and list it twice so that it would say Hill, Anita here, and another name affixed to that at another point. And that the two could be put together in that way. But very confusing, and it really is like I would be sitting down doing sort of homosexuality 101 kind of education with every time we had new people come in to take the church directory, whichever company it was for that particular year. or whether it was all right to list anniversaries of gay and lesbian people in the monthly newsletter that went out from the church along with other heterosexual anniversaries. And we finally came to a place of ease about that, but the discomfort that was raised by that, people said, this is flaunting it. Well, is it flaunting heterosexuality to wear wedding rings and introduce yourself and children or other? And we don't see it in that way. And some of it is, as I mentioned yesterday, that in our minds, gay and lesbian people have become so over-sexualized that that's the only context in which we think of them. We don't have very many images of gay and lesbian people, you know, mowing the lawn, going to work, paying taxes, emptying the garbage. And that's not how we think of them in those kind of contexts. And yet, you know, we're just people too. Sometimes I think if I had to be as sexual as the stereotype set me up to be, I'd be too tired to teach. I couldn't come to do this. You know, just would not work. Allison.
I guess this comment goes back just a little bit to how Carol was talking about the sexism within the structure of the church institution. And I think that one of the fundamental things that needs to be done in answer to this question, how should the church address committed gay lesbian relationships, is that it needs to be done within the context of the church addressing sexism as well. Because the two issues of oppression, you know, the silence or invisibility or the harassment of the gay and lesbian community is so closely linked to sexism in our culture, you know, and whether that sexism has been historically as strong at all points or not, we live in a culture currently that has really strict gender roles that are set out and expectations for what it is to be male and female. And one of the ways in which gay and lesbian people tend to get in trouble in our culture is because they're perceived to be upsetting those roles. You know, the gay men are perceived to be feminine, and that's somehow a negative thing. And my question is, if it were a positive thing to be feminine in this culture, would the same kind of backlash against a man who's perceived to be feminine occur? But it's seen as this hugely awful thing for a man to be perceived as feminine in any kind of way, and I take that as a woman pretty personally. You know, it's like, what?
And there are less strictures about women.
Well, there are less
taking on roles of that are described as a masculine stereotype. There's more leeway in that regard. Women can choose to wear pants or skirts as they will. Guys who are wearing even a shirt made out of a nylon or rayon or silk kind of fabric. There's something about the softness of the fabric even that is connected with femininity that's not okay.
I guess I would say, though, that I think you're right in that there are less strictures for women's options, because if a woman is perceived as being masculine, these male attributes are in general positive things in our culture.
Yes, exactly.
Assertive or well-spoken or whatever the, you know, the
independent
list is.
Yeah.
But one of the problems I see is that when women are sensed to be stepping out of a stereotypically feminine role, there is this response of, oh, they're taking over a man's role, or they're trying to usurp power that does not belong to them, because of the power in our culture. You know, men are able to have positions of power and women aren't. And if women are perceived to be too strong or too aggressive or anything else, there's this need somehow to put them back in their place.
Mm-hmm.
You know? How dare a woman be trying to live a life unattached to a man? That kind of thing.
Okay.
I found the study guide, which I got a couple days ago, to be really thought-provoking. And I figure I'm only one person, but I'm really concerned about this, and I'm going to take it back and talk to my pastor about it. It's got some great little stories.
The particular section that we're, that we're working in today starts out with a set of little vignettes, four of them, talking about Betty and Alice, who've been good friends and roommates for 4 years. Neither has had a serious sexual relationship with a man or a woman. They have become increasingly close to one another, value their deep friendship, and have begun to recognize the sexual attraction they feel toward one another. Goes on, talks about a high school student who's male, who's feeling very attracted to the person who is his lab partner, and fearful to say anything about that because of the comments and things that he's heard from others about same-gender people. Says he's kept his feelings a secret from his family and his pastor, and he's been feeling more and more depressed lately. Recently thought about ending his life rather than facing the hostility and rejection he is sure that will come if he does come forward. So those kind of vignettes are there throughout the document, also looking at relationships outside of marriage, which I think I had tried to encompass far too much in each hour as I put this together, so I had thought we'd be spending some time on that today as well. But there are some similarities in the way in which we're looking at these two. Yes?
Just kind of responding to these two comments about the kind of systemic change in culture that needs mm-hmm. to take place. But then we have to come back to, in the meantime, what are we going to do?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how are we going to live?
Right.
Within the unjust structures that mm-hmm. we have to live in. And maybe, you know, maybe the greatest thing is we can nudge society a little bit, but how are we going to live within the limitations
mm-hmm.
the way life is dealt with to us?
Yes.
How are we going to be church together for
exactly.
I have one suggestion. Taking those books back, and our church just finished that discussion group. And we had a cross-section of people, we had old people, young people. I mean, it's the first time we've made jokes about talking about sex in the Lutheran church, because it's the first time it's ever been talked about that I remember. I mean, people didn't talk. That book covers not only gay-lesbian relationships, it covers relationships, it covers a myriad of sexuality. And I think it's just healthy to be talking about it. But to me, a first step is getting people talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Doing some permission giving.
Yeah, because there's this higher power base that you had talked about, but the reality is they get their power from us. If everybody else in the Lutheran church walked out and said, no, not today, we're not, they would have no power. I mean, that's a reality of being an upper level power person, is you also have to be listening to people on all the levels. And I just think it's really healthy that, I mean, it's the first time I signed up for the discussion group, because it's the first time anywhere in my life that anybody's ever talked about sex.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was wonderful.
Yeah, I would really encourage people to gather a group of folks within your congregational settings to discuss it, and to take some time with it so that you have 6 or 8 sessions of an hour and a half or two together to begin to get to know each other as well and build some trust to be able to talk about things. Because in some ways, it's safer to come here with a bunch of strangers who I met on the bus day before yesterday
mm-hmm.
and talk about this and go back home, and then the people in my own church don't really know how I think about these issues after all. So it's a bit riskier maybe to do it back at that home setting. Next week, the whole series, the focus is going to be looking at issues of homophobia and how our church responds, looking at homophobia as a spiritual affliction, exploring, at least for one whole session, the question that was raised about the interconnections between homophobia and sexism. One of the books that I had asked for to have in the bookstore just came yesterday that's called Homophobia, A Weapon of Sexism. It's written by Suzanne Farr and is exploring that whole question. Her professional career has been working in the battered women's movement in shelters and places for battered women, and speaks of having done workshops about homophobia in those settings and had the people there in small group write down what it would be like to have a world without homophobia.
What is homophobia?
Homophobia means fear of people who are same gender. Fear of our own attraction toward people who are same gender, or fear of being labeled gay or lesbian, which is a pretty big one that keeps part of the way we keep people in the stereotypical what it means to be male or female box, is the threat that if you step too far outside that, you'll be labeled as gay or lesbian. But she said all the answers came back time and again that people were saying they were describing a world without sexism, a world with equality between the two genders that we have, and began to pique for her interest in the interconnections between these two arenas. Another is Beverly Harrison, who's a writer in that regard, in a book called Making the Connections, which is available here in the bookstore. Well, we have passed by about 2 minutes, our ending time for today. I will stay if people want to talk further, but we can come to an end of the roll of the tape. Thank you.